Welcome to the Northeast Christian Podcast. We're so excited that you've decided to check out our weekly messages. We hope that you're challenged and inspired by what you're hearing today. We'd love to have you join us this weekend at one of our campuses or online at northeast.live. For more information on Northeast, visit us at necchurch.org. If you love the Northeast Podcast, subscribe to our channel and leave us a comment or a rating in the Apple Podcast Store. This weekend's message is from Tyler McKenzie. He's the lead pastor here at Northeast.
All right, well, let's begin our sermon today with a little bit of apocalyptic scripture reading. Are you ready for this? I know it's what we've all been waiting for, right? I know that Contagion, the movie, is in the top 10 on the iTunes store. I know that Outbreak is like the number 5 most popular streamed video on Netflix right now. 1995 film, Dustin Hoffman. Got like a 59% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's pretty average. But people are watching it. And why? Because we know it's the end of the world as we know it. So what does the scripture have to say about the end of the world? Well, the Apostle Paul writes this in 2 Timothy chapter 3, and it's one of my favorite last days passages. Check this out. Paul says, "You should know this, Timothy, that in the last days," the what days? Well, the last days, "there will be very difficult times. For people will," and are you ready for it? Okay, here's the sign of the times. Paul says, "For people will love only themselves and their money." Now, pause for a second. And let's just take note. What does Paul say will be the sign of the times? Is it a pandemic? Is it an earthquake? Is it hordes of locusts or natural disasters? Well, no, not exactly. Is it microchips planted into our hand by Bill Gates? No, not exactly. Is it Obama? No, wait, Trump. No, wait, China. Setting up a one world government? Well, no, not exactly. Rather, the Apostle Paul says that the sign of the times will be what I'm calling today apocalyptic self-indulgence. People will love only themselves and their money. Sound familiar? Paul goes on to describe it like this, verse 2. He says, "They'll be boastful and proud, scoffing at God, disobedient to their parents and ungrateful. They'll consider nothing sacred. They'll be unloving and unforgiving. They will slander others and have no self-control. They'll be cruel, hate what is good. They'll betray their friends, be reckless, be puffed up with pride, and love pleasure rather than God. They'll act religious, but they will reject the power that can make them godly. Stay away," he says, "stay away from people like that." To which we're all like, "Paul, isn't like everybody like that?" Well, okay, to a certain degree. Now, at this point, I think it's important to pause and tell you that if we were in like a Bible class right now, and I were teaching you on the concept of the last days in the writings of Paul or the New Testament authors, it'd be important to point out that Paul didn't see the last days as like this apocalyptic moment. Rather, he saw it as an entire era of salvation history that began with the first coming of Jesus and ended with the second coming of Jesus. So Paul would have told you, "Yes, I'm living in the last days." But if Paul lived with us 2,000 years later, he'd say, "Yeah, you too, you're living in the last days because we're living between the first coming and the second coming of Jesus." In fact, this is why the New Testament authors oftentimes write with such urgency. They're like, "We got to tell them about Jesus. We got to show them his love, and we got to do it today because we don't know when the second coming is going to be," right? Could be 2,000 years from now, could be tomorrow, could be 5 minutes from now before this sermon is over with. Okay, and I'll go ahead and tell you, if apocalyptic self-indulgence is the sign of the times, then our culture better keep its eye on the sky. Isn't the truth? Now, we don't call it self-indulgence in our culture because, well, apocalyptic self-indulgence just sounds so selfish. So we use more palatable words like freedom. Sounds a whole lot better to say, "I love freedom," rather than "I love my." That's basically what we mean when we say freedom. In our culture, we define freedom as the self-autonomy to do whatever I want to do. So it's really all just wordplay. We say things like, you know, "You do you," but really we mean "I'm going to do whatever I want." Or we say things like "follow your heart," but really we mean "I'm going to do whatever I feel." like doing. Or we say things like, find your truth, but really we mean, I'll decide. I'll decide what's true for me. Maybe the best example of this during COVID-19 was the college spring breakers, who still went on spring break even though social quarantine was instated. Do you guys remember this? I remember the kid who got on the news and he gave us this quote. It's just mind blower. He said, look, if I get corona, I get corona. At the end of the day, I'm not gonna let it stop me from partying. Now, the clip went viral after that. The kid got absolutely eviscerated on social media. In fact, he came back in the Cincinnati Inquirer and he issued a public apology. He was like, look, I didn't even know what I was saying. And for me, I'm gonna show him a little grace, because in college, there were things I did that I didn't know what I was doing, things I said that I didn't even know what I was saying. But then after this kid said it and it all went viral, it's very interesting. It all got blamed on the millennials. Now, can we pause for a second, okay, and sidebar conversation? Let me talk about something that has absolutely nothing to do with the sermon, millennials. You do know that millennials are like me, right? They're not like teenagers anymore. They're like in their 30s, and they have jobs. Maybe they're your boss. They have 401ks, a minivan, 3 children, and they spend most of their time wondering when they might be able to catch a nap, changing diapers, and wondering why their metabolism doesn't work as well anymore, okay? So can we just drop the whole millennial thing? Okay, can we start blaming all of our parenting failures on the next worst generation ever, because that's what old people like to do? All right, back to the sermon. Sorry. Now, what am I saying here? This is what I'm saying. It's not the kid's fault. Rather, it's the culture's fault. It's our culture's obsession with apocalyptic freedom. And it's infecting us all, young and old, left and right. In fact, I would suggest to you today that that's the one belief that unites the left and the right anymore. Freedom. It's this idea, this belief, that freedom will ultimately save us. Now, the left and right fight this battle on different fronts, but this belief is the core of it all. The right says things like, you know, we need freedom from the federal government, freedom to practice my irrevocable First Amendment rights, freedom from government-controlled markets, freedom from social taxation on my money, freedom from the tyranny of cloth masks on my face. And then on the left, it's still all about freedom. They just have different issues. You know, freedom from oppressive traditional authorities, freedom from the influence of religion in public life, freedom from pre-existing norms on the family unit, gender, sexuality, church, politics. Total deconstruction of our culture. Just burn the whole thing down. It's all about freedom. Now, with that being said, I want to make this important point here, okay? I'm not anti-freedom. I think freedom's a good thing. In fact, I think that every human being needs freedom in order to thrive in life. People who are in slavery do not have enough freedom. People who are in abusive domestic situations, they do not have enough freedom. People who live in political environments like North Korea, they don't have enough freedom. They need more of it. However, there is such a thing as having too much freedom to your own self-destruction. Charles Taylor, really, really groundbreaking philosopher of our time, said it like this. He said, to have any kind of livable society, some choices have to be restricted. Some authorities have to be respected. And some responsibility has to be assumed. And this is where I think Christianity offers a vision of freedom that is so countercultural to our culture today, and also such a bright light for all of us to wrap our minds and our hearts around. You see, Jesus is all about freedom too. But when Jesus says freedom, he's talking about something totally different than what people in our culture are talking about. So let me explain. Basically, if philosophers were to parse out the difference between the two, they would say Jesus' freedom versus, well, our secular culture's freedom is the difference between absolute negative freedom and positive freedom. Now, what's absolute negative freedom? Well, it's this idea that you're free from, okay? It's the difference between free from versus free to. It's the idea that you're free from all restraints. That's what our culture disciples us into. Now, on the flip side, though, positive freedom isn't the freedom from everything, but it's the freedom to take your life and give it to some good end, to pursue some higher cause. So on the ground, this is what our culture would tell you. It would tell you self-autonomy is what will set you free. You have to cut yourself loose from all external authorities and look within yourself. That's where you'll find freedom. While on the flip side, Christianity would tell you that love, that's the good end you should pursue with your life. Giving your life to love is actually what will set you free. Or said differently, our culture would say, protecting my freedoms is the key to life. It's the key to happiness. While Christianity would say quite the opposite. It would say sacrificing my freedoms is the key to life. It's the key to human thriving. Now, I heard one author say it like this once, and I thought it was so good. He said, true freedom is found not in the absence of all restrictions, but the presence of the right restrictions, the right rules, the right authorities. Hey, let me give you an example. Let's say your doctor told you, hey, you need to knock off all that unhealthy eating. You got to stop eating all the junk food, the sugars, the fatty foods, whatever. Okay, because if you don't, your life is going to be dramatically affected. You're not going to be as healthy. You're not going to live as long. Now, in that moment, you have the freedom to continue to eat whatever you want to eat. But if you choose to sacrifice that lesser freedom of eating whatever you want, then you will experience, in turn, the greater freedom of living a longer, healthier life. You see how this works? Let's say, occupationally, you want to be a master at your craft. You want to be a master pianist. You want to create music for a living, music that moves people. Well, in order to experience that greater freedom, you're going to have to sacrifice some of your lesser freedoms. You're going to have to give 8 to 10 hours a day practicing, writing, creating, performing for your entire life if you ever want to experience the greater freedom of expertise and mastery. Maybe the best example of how this works out in really just conventional wisdom is love. Love relationships. I'll tell you, you want to know what will undermine a relationship fast? If both parties come in and say, I'm going to exercise my individual freedoms. I do me, you do you. I'm going to do what I feel like, you do what you feel like. I'm going to create my truth, you create your truth, and we'll see how long this chemistry lasts. That's a path to self-destruction. And no wonder people feel lonely, they don't have friends, and marriages fall apart more often than not in our culture today. So you know what the key to a love relationship is? It's the sacrifice, the mutual sacrifice of individual freedoms for the greater freedom of love with one another. You see how this works? I'm for you. No, I'm for you. That's the key. The Apostle Paul actually says it like this in Galatians 5:13. This passage is fascinating to me. He just nails it. Paul says, for you were called to freedom. Brothers and sisters, you're called to it. Only do not use your freedom as what? Oh, he's preaching to us now. As an opportunity for self-indulgence. But through love. Use your freedom for what love? But through love, become slaves to one another. For the whole law is summed up in a single commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, dare I say it? Christian love, this is what it looks like. Christian freedom, this is what it looks like. It's found in love. Or maybe I could say it in a little bit more of a culturally appropriate way today. Okay. Exercising religious liberty, or at least the Christian kind, is less about the First Amendment and more about the great commandment that Paul recites for us there, found in Jesus. Now, Tyler, why would you say that? Well, the reason why I say that is because there's a debate going on right now in both the public and political square on religious freedom and church and all that. And I'm a religious church leader, so I think I should probably weigh in on it for a second. Here's how the debate goes. We should either preserve religious liberty or preserve public safety. Choose your side. Now, whenever I hear the talking heads go at each other's throats on this, I always leave their arguments thinking there's just not enough nuance there. In fact, I always leave the arguments thinking, does it really have to be an or? Preserve religious liberty or preserve public safety? Or can it be both? Because you see, for the Christian who's exercising the Christian freedom to love their neighbor, well, I think they'll find that loving their neighbor actually means both. Did you know that one of the most neighbor-loving things you could do is preserve the religious liberty of your neighbor? Most people in the United States of America are religious, and part of acknowledging their dignity is making sure that they have the right to choose who and how they worship. I mean, read a history book if you haven't, because when the state, the government, marries itself to a religion, things always go south fast. Plus, we know that Jesus is not a coercive God. Rather, Jesus doesn't want to force people into Christianity through like legislation. He wants to love people into a relationship with him and experience love in return. One of the best ways to love your neighbor is preserving their right to religious freedom. And I think Christianity thrives in an environment like that. Okay, and then dare I say it in the same breath, I also think preserving public safety is like important. I don't know. Loving your neighbor is making sure that they don't die. Wouldn't you agree with me on that? So there has to be more nuance here. Okay, I want to go back to Galatians 5:13 because Paul does something really fascinating here. All right, and I've added verse 15 because this is what he does. I'm going to read the whole thing to you again, but pay attention to 15 when I get there. He says, "You're called to freedom, brothers and sisters, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence, but through love become slaves to one another, for the whole law is summed up in a single commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself. If, though," he says, "if, however, you bite and devour one another," or in other words, he says, "if you choose self-indulgence, the freedom to self-indulge rather than the freedom to love neighbor, if you choose that, take care that you are not consumed by one another." Or in other words, he just says, you're gonna consume one another. And isn't that America today? People choose their little tribes, choose their sides, and we just bite and devour one another until we consume the other. Okay, so here's what I believe. I believe the loss of nuance is a sure sign of the loss of love. The loss of nuance in public discourse is a sure sign of a loss of love in a national community. Now, you know what nuance is, right? Nuance is just recognizing that the issue is usually more complex than what it's presented as in the this side or that version on the news. It's recognizing the fact that there are hundreds of millions of people in America, and all those people have unique backgrounds, unique experiences, unique upbringings, unique genetics. They had different parents. They have different sins and trauma and regrets and stress and stressors in their past. They're different people. And so through the lens of their own life and life experiences, they see issues differently. So issues are always more complex than just A or B. Choose your side. But that's not what we like in America. You know what we like in America? We like what I call talking point truth. Talking point truth. We like to go to our favorite Twitter follow, or we like to go to our favorite news outlet and just consume their talking points because they're witty and punchy and cute. And then we tweet them without any regard for the fact that the talking point sucks the humanity out of our opponent. It misrepresents their intentions and motivations more often than not, and it buries all of the nuance of the argument into a little 140 character tweet that we can go on social media, drop that fire, drop the mic, and be done with. But that's not love, is it? That's not how we're supposed to use our freedom, Christians. Okay, so I'll give you another argument that lacks a lot of nuance today. You may have heard it. Save the economy or flatten the curve. Choose your side. Let it run its course, they say, or just relax and watch Netflix. This will all blow over soon. Chill out. Choose your side. And I believe that both sides lack nuance. So I'll tell you this. If you are able right now to just kind of stay at home and watch Netflix and wait it out, you are very privileged. And you should be grateful to God for that. I'm very privileged. I'm grateful, but I know for a fact that in our church right now, there are hundreds of people. In our city right now, there are thousands of people who are suffering. They're suffering because they've lost their job. They're suffering because they've had to close down their small business. They're suffering because they can't pay their bills or they're worried about their kids. They're suffering because, well, they're literally living off the canned goods from our food pantry. They're suffering because their mental health is declining. And every day the economy stays closed is another day where that suffering gets harder and harder for them. Look, this is what I'm saying. If you can just wait it out and watch Netflix, well, good for you, but that's not everyone's situation. It's more nuanced than that. But on the flip side, let it run its course. Like, let it run its course. You know what that's code for? That's code for let it run its course, and if the elderly die, the elderly die. Because grandma would sacrifice her life for the economy anyways, right? So just let it run its course. Sacrifice the elderly and the vulnerable. Like, really? What sounds remotely Christian about that? Prosperity over people? Show me that Bible verse. My American way of life over your life. Show me those red letters from Jesus. So you know what Christians are supposed to be? Christians are supposed to be the advocates, the servants. They're supposed to be at their very best when it comes to loving the least and the vulnerable in our society. We're not called to make economic calculations about whose lives are more expendable or less expendable. And yet we've got one side of the aisle right now who think the unborn are expendable and another side of the aisle who think the elderly are expendable. We're better than that. It's more nuanced than this. What happened to our ethic of life? And you know what? Is it possible? You think it's possible to love both? Like to love everyone? I do. In fact, that's what our church is engaged in right now. We're trying our best, as imperfectly as it may be. We're trying to love the vulnerable and the elderly by making deliveries for them, checking in on them, and making sure we don't open up too soon, too fast, or without wisdom. But at the same time, we're trying to love those who are suffering from our floundering economy. We've sent money to healthcare practitioners in our community in order to make sure that people who can no longer afford their mental health counseling sessions can still afford them. We're working with people to help them find unemployment or find jobs, feeding their families in the meantime, connecting them with organizations that can help them pay their bills or figure out financial solutions. We're working with small businesses. We created a mentor match program, literally, so that small businesses could get connected with wiser others who could tell them how to navigate this, get them connected to a good banker, or help them figure out the pathway to government funding. We're in the trenches. We're trying to love them all because that's what we believe our responsibility is. It's what Christian freedom looks like. One of my favorite partnerships was one we got to have recently with Chancey Elementary. Our very first intimate partner school. They called us up and they said, hey, we need your help with something. We're like, what's up? They're like, well, we want to appreciate teachers. We want to support a local small business. And we also want to give you an opportunity to love your neighbor. And we're like, tell us more. And like, well, what we want to do is we want to go to Sally Limon, Mexican restaurant that's right across the street from your church, buy $1,000 worth of gift cards and give them out to our teachers. Why Sally Limon? Because that's a Chancey Elementary family. And we were like, man, three-pointer, right? Appreciate teachers, love a local business, and take care of one of our neighbors. We're all over that. One of our other school partners reached out to us and they said, hey, we've identified a family that we're really worried about. They haven't been showing up to the feeding program. And so would your church take a box of food out to their house and just check on them? We're like, sure, of course. So one of our stakeholders named Nicole went out just to check on them. And when she got there with the box of food, two of the young girls, both under the age of 6, came to the door. And when they saw that the box was full of food, they rejoiced. They said, Mom, comida, comida, comida. Because who knows the last time that they actually got to eat? Church, my hat's off to you. in just 2 months' time, we've collected over 175,000 items, whether that be in the form of snack packs, hygiene kits, canned goods, cleaning supplies. We've stepped up for our community. Over 250 individual families have been served, 25 different schools, 35 different zip codes, 40 different NGOs. In fact, the network of community food pantries over the last 2 months have experienced shortage in terms of food and funding. And so guess where they turned in order to stock their pantries? Our church. Over the last 2 months, we've literally been feeding the city. That's what love looks like. That's what Christian freedom looks like. We can love them all, but only if we're willing to sacrifice in big ways. Here's another debate that's happening in the public square. Church should reopen, or church should stay closed. Where's Northeast land on that? Well, I'll tell you this. I am very, very thankful that we have the opportunity as a leadership, the religious liberty, if you will, to be able to choose when and how we open. But at the same time, just because we have those rights doesn't mean we need to exercise them now. We need to make sure that we're leading with love and being wise. For those of you who didn't see it, about a week ago, the governor released guidelines for churches that he's asking churches to respect when they reopen in order to keep people safe. And I just want you to see them real quick so you'll see the situation that we're dealt with. First, he said that we should only open up our rooms at 33% capacity, which means that if we were going to fit everybody in our Brownsboro campus and Clifton campus, we would have to have 9 different services just to be safe. Oh, and by the way, we'd have to come up with some sort of ticketing system to make sure that too many people didn't show up at one service. And oh, by the way, we'd have to sanitize before every single one of those services to make sure that the environment was clean. That's a lot of resources in terms of finances and in terms of staff sweat equity. Now, on top of that, what would those services look like? Well, there would be no children's ministry or childcare. There would be a 6-foot radius between everyone, masks for everyone, no congregational singing because that spreads the droplets, which spreads the virus, even worse than just talking. There'd be no communion, no communal food at all, no passing the offering plates, no physical touching, hugging, handshaking, greeting one another with a holy kiss. That verse didn't age well. They're asking us also to take people's temperature at the door. If they have 100.5 or more, not to allow them in. No high risk populations should be invited. There'd be new signage everywhere to make sure that everybody knows the different health regulations. We'd have to provide hand sanitizer, hand washing stations, and also there's strict restroom sanitation regulations. By that, I mean they're asking us not to have restrooms. But if we have to, only one person can go in the restroom at a time, and then we have to sanitize the whole thing after, which would be a logistical nightmare here. So you started to get my point here. In order for us to be wise and safe and wise stewards, I don't know if reopening quite yet is the best thing to do. Again, recap for you. No kids service, no communion, no offering, no singing, no congregating, no communal areas. Basically, it would just be a sermon. And since there are 9 services, I would not be able to preach at all those services, so it would be a sermon on a screen. And you tell me, what makes that environment better than the environment that you're experiencing right now? Nothing. See, in the mind of our leadership, we believe that it would be a drastically diminished environment in terms of excellence, faithfulness, and safety. It wouldn't be wise stewardship of our money. We'd rather our money be going out to love the ville rather than spending it all and making sure that we're getting everything set up for an hour, for 1 hour. There's a lot more hours in a week, right? And we're concerned about our witness in the community. Because you see, while everybody on the inside is excited about getting back together, and if we were to reopen right now, some Christians would be like, yeah! The very people who were trying to reach on the outside would roll their eyes. And they would say, well, I can tell you what you can do with your religious liberty. So here's our plan going forward. We're going to continue to move forward with our house church model. It's only for a season, but we think it can be a really effective and fruitful season for our church. Next week on May 24th, we're going to have what we're calling Ordination Day. It's going to be a very special weekend with powerful worship elements. You do not want to miss it. Right? And what we're going to do is we're going to explain what it looks like to have a church in your house, a watch party, if you will, which is as easy as that. It's as easy as pushing play. But we're going to explain it all next weekend, show you how to get the training, pray over you, commission you, ordain you, if you will, to be the pastors of your home. And then on May 31st, we're going to watch launch parties. And my hope is that by the end of all this, we launch over 300 new Northeast campuses. Now, some of you are like, why May 31st? Well, it gives us enough time to prepare you. And also, the government is asking us to wait until May 25th before social gatherings of 10 or less. So May 31st, get your 10 together. Let's be ready for it. Now, here's what we're asking you to do in the meantime. Four things. All right, and we need our church to rally around these. One, we're asking everyone to stay positive. This is different. This is change. People usually don't like change. But there's potential in this season. So stay positive. Leading is hard right now. I'm not saying that so you'll have pity on me. I'm just saying that as a reality. No matter where you lead, you know this. If you lead in the home, if you lead in for-profit, non-profit, if you lead a team, if you lead in the church, leadership is hard right now. We're all facing the same realities. But the way those realities work themselves out in our unique leadership contexts are all really, really different. So it's going to look different opening up Northeast Christian Church than it is opening up the economy or a restaurant. It's going to look different opening up a big church versus a small church. It's going to look different opening up our Brownsboro campus versus our Clifton campus. It's different. There's lots of nuance involved. So I'm asking you to stay positive, stay supportive, and trust our leadership that we are doing our very best to lead with wisdom and to lead with love. If you're one of those folks out there right now who you're like, you know, but Tyler, I really want to get back together in our building. Know this, so do we, but not at the expense of wisdom and love. If you're someone out there who's like, yeah, I like our church's model, and those churches are open up way too soon over there. And what do you think about that, Tyler? Well, here's what I think. I think we should give them the benefit of the doubt. That's what love does. It doesn't judge. Rather, love offers the benefit of the doubt. And I promise you, a lot of the church leaders in our community are good leaders, and they're trying to do their best as well. So let's stay positive through this. Second, let's start planning. Start planning your watch party now. Okay, we're going to train you on how to do it safely and effectively over the next couple weeks. But who are your 10? If you haven't like sent out a text or initiated a conversation, get on that. All right, now, it's only going to be 10 people, so it's probably your immediate family or just your closest friends. But initiate that conversation. Figure out what cul-de-sac, parking lot, backyard, living room you're going to meet in. And who's going to lead it. And get that ball rolling ahead of time. Third, embrace this moment. Embrace this moment. What a moment this is. Let me remind you that 2,000 years ago, the first church started in homes and little gatherings of like, oh, I don't know, 10. And they took over an empire. And we have that opportunity to get back to our roots today. That's exciting to me. In fact, you know what I think our challenge will be going forward? Our challenge is not going to be the space to meet, because we have as many spaces as we have living rooms, cul-de-sacs, backyards, and driveways. No, our challenge is going to be our willingness to change. Will we be willing to lay down our church preferences for the sake of our Love the Ville church to see it thrive, to see it grow? If we do, I'll tell you this, it will grow. If we lean into this moment, I can promise you this, you will grow. And we will reach people for Jesus that we never could have imagined otherwise. So let's embrace this moment, because this is our moment. Love the Ville Church. Which leads me to number four, and let's not forget this. Last. If all else fails, if we get nothing else right, let's just continue to get this right. Let's unleash Jesus' love every day, everybody, everywhere. Because love is where freedom is found. Love is where Jesus is found. Love is God. And God is love. And if we lead with love, then nothing else matters. So let's go love the Ville. Our church would never pray for this moment, but the Love the Ville church was made for this moment. Let's rise to the occasion. Seize the opportunity, church.